Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the Tuesday Stand-Up. Today is February 23rd, and once again, I'm really pleased to welcome Bill Vaughn, who is the Vice President of Education and Clinical Affairs with Remedy, as well as Jennifer Hardesty. And Jennifer is the Chief Clinical Officer and Corporate Compliance Officer with Remedy Senior Care. And for today, Tuesday Stand-Up, our topic is insulin, reducing risks, and improving outcomes. And just as a very gentle reminder, in 2 weeks, we will welcome everybody back, and our topic on March 8th will be focused surveys, adverse drug events. So thank you for joining Tuesday. My name is Ann Patterson with Leading Age Maryland, and at this time, I'm going to turn the call over to Bill Vaughn and Jen Hardesty.
Hey, Ann, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. We're glad to be talking to you on this Tuesday. This is the first Tuesday we've had with you when there hasn't been, you know, several inches of snow on the ground. So we think this is a step in the right direction. So for the next 15 minutes or so, Jen and I are going to address insulin. On my piece, I'm going to address it from a regulatory end. So again, this will be in the context of regulations. And as a reminder, the July 17th memo from CMS that talks about CMS interest in high-risk drugs and focus surveys coming about to take a look at how your facilities are handling high-risk drugs. Certainly, insulin, by definition, is a high-risk drug. It can do very good things for people, but it can also very quickly and efficiently hurt people if used in the wrong direction. Rising rates of obesity has led to increased rates of diabetes, and we're seeing that in our long-term care facilities. Actually, we're seeing it all the way across healthcare, but we're seeing it in long-term care facilities. And quite frankly, insulin management has always been low-hanging fruit for surveyors. It's very easy to see. It's a relatively black-and-white management system, so surveyors gravitate towards what the finger stick was, how much insulin did you give, and so on. So let me address this through what I've done commonly on these calls, and that is by looking at a reg F329 that talks about unnecessary drugs, and let me apply the parameters under 329 to insulin. So the first aspect of 329 talks about excessive dose, and in my experience, this kind of looked at a couple different things. Certainly, bridging with oral agents, sometimes people are started on insulin and then bridge over to oral agents, vice versa. It's important to remember that both insulin and oral diabetic agents can lower blood sugars, and it's important to be very cognizant of how they're being used and the timing of which. Sliding scale, and Jen's going to address the current state of affairs for sliding scale and geriatrics, but sliding scale can often lead to excessive dose depending on the clinical condition of the resident, the finger sticks you get, and it's a very cautionary tale to use sliding scale in the elderly. When I look at excessive dose, I also think of medication errors. So insulin is notorious in terms of being error-prone when it's drawn up and given, so much so that we've had facilities require two nurses to look at every dose of insulin drawn to make sure that there's not a calculation error or just a basic medication error happening. So again, excessive dose can occur even when people are well-intentioned, but a medication error occurs. Excessive duration is the next thing we'll look at. So common things that I've seen in the past include sometimes people with diabetes, when they get infection, if their diabetes goes out of control, and they require insulin coverage during that unique time period. However, once the infection resolves, generally their glycemic control improves. I've seen cases where people have forgotten to take them off insulin, and they ended up with resulting low blood sugar because of it. Similarly, people that are on steroids sometimes develop excessive blood sugars, and sometimes you need short courses of insulin to treat steroid-dependent. These are particularly higher doses. Again, once that dose of steroid is lowered, typically the need for insulin goes away, and that's something to keep in mind. And then lastly, in terms of duration, always looking at insulin in the context of people's goals of care. So when you look at people on end-of-life care, it's important to know whether or not insulin is appropriate in those circumstances, as well as people with advanced dementia and other conditions where there's a risk-benefit analysis that may argue against the continued use of insulin. Monitoring is another area that gets a lot of attention with insulin. Things as basic as people that are getting finger sticks, coordinating them with the person giving the medication. Sometimes we see that being done by two individuals, and it's important for the person giving the insulin, obviously, to know what the last finger stick was. It's also important to, when you see particularly hypoglycemia, it's defined more than just by a number. So I've seen people with blood sugars of 48 that were alert and competent and able to talk and not really clinically symptomatic. And I've seen people obtunded with blood sugars in the 50s. So I think I would suggest to facilities is that when nurses do finger sticks and get low blood sugars, that they comment on the residents' clinical condition as well. There's different approaches to how one would treat someone who's obtunded with a blood sugar of 50 and someone who's still very alert and active with it. Oftentimes, there's orders and records to monitor insulin versus other monitoring approaches. So it's important to know that while a doc may want blood sugars monitored at certain intervals, there's certainly no restrictions on looking at a change in mental status in a diabetic and getting a finger stick. As a matter of fact, I would argue that's a standard of care. Additionally, I kind of get concerned when I see orders to talk about notification parameters. So if a doc says, call with a blood sugar less than 60 and greater than 400, if the patient has a blood sugar of 62 but has a change in the status, the doc should be called. Similarly, I've seen cases where consistently people have had unusual blood sugars of 390, 395, and the nursing staff didn't call the physician because it didn't meet that exact parameter. So while parameters may be helpful, they always have to be put in the context of the clinical condition of the patient. And then I do believe that it's generally a standard of care to, with some frequency, monitor a resident's hemoglobin A1C, which is going to look at a longer-term control of someone's blood sugar. Next part of 329 talks about adequate indication for use. So two areas which I see are problematic under this is sometimes hospital discharge summaries contain orders for insulin that were appropriate when the resident was acutely on the hospital but are not appropriate once they enter the long-term care facility and are clinically different. So simply following a hospital discharge summary, as we've talked about before, can be problematic because frequently people are, not frequently. If someone that's discharged from a hospital generally has improved, and it's important to make sure the medicine is put in context of that improvement. And secondly, adequate indication for use also looks at the current standards of practice that generally argues against very tight control of blood sugars in geriatrics. Again, to put it mildly, I think hyperglycemia kills you in the long run because it adversely affects your ends organs, but that takes years to happen. Hypoglycemia, and that with aggressive control of blood sugar, can kill you very quickly. So I think the general standard is that tight control in geriatrics is not what is preferred because of the risk-benefit analysis. Adverse consequences when it comes to insulin, these are fairly basic. Someone stops eating and drinking, if you continue to give the same dose of insulin, you're likely to have a bad outcome. People with repeat hypoglycemia that don't affect a change in the insulin can be problematic. I think I've seen problems with how facilities respond to hypoglycemia. Some facilities very aggressively give glucagon to everyone. Some use PO sugar. And I think there ought to be a standard approach to how facilities treat hypoglycemia. One of the problems is you can sugar load somebody to get their blood sugar up, and then it takes, hours or days to get their blood sugar back down. So you have to be cognizant of that. And then a question I would have for facilities is if someone has a adverse event from insulin and develops hypoglycemia, and let's say they even become obtunded, is that something that requires hospital evaluation or can that be done in your facility? I think many times it can be done in facilities, but you ought to have a consistent approach to that. Again, on these calls, I've pretty much emphasized what we think is a standard geriatric principle that any symptom in an elderly patient should be considered a drug side effect until proven otherwise. And certainly in a diabetic on insulin or oral hypoglycemic agents, changes in condition ought to make you think about high-risk drugs, which, of course, insulin would be. And we ought to look at whether or not that's causing the change. Lastly, from my end, although the QAPI regs are not out yet, we think they're coming, and we think they will be generally looking like they were when they were published. So, again, insulin usage and management lends itself to a QAPI approach because You can get robust data on how your insulin is being used. You can partner with your pharmacies and perhaps even with your labs to gather data about insulin use. And again, this would be in line with the kind of performance improvement projects that CMS envisions for the QAPI regs to look at insulin if your facility is in fact having issues. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jen to talk about the kind of clinical and operational issues involved in insulin management.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And I actually have one point to bring up about QAPI. What we've seen some of our facilities start to do is pull monthly reports on glucagon use, because that, in many cases, is a good indicator of either problematic issues with sliding scale insulin or other insulin clinically, and also operationally. Are the nurses glucagon kits and they're just sitting in the carts not being used because that's what was on the hospital discharge summary, or can they just go to the emergency kit and get it that way because they are fairly expensive. So moving on, some clinical recommendations that I have that I see. You know, we talk a lot about sliding scale, and from a regulatory perspective, sliding scale is really meant to be the only insulin that patients are on sliding scale. That's the kind of the bad sliding scale. So if patient is only on regular insulin four times a day with no other insulin or basal products, that's really the sliding scale that, from a regulatory perspective, we're looking at moving away from. What we do see, though, now with the way that insulin treatment has evolved is the basal bolus regimen. So in many cases, you'll see a bit of a sliding scale method on top of this basal bolus regimen. So you'll have a once-a-day long-acting insulin given, and then on top of that, three or four times a day, you'll have little boluses given and of the shorter-acting insulin, and that's really to help mimic the physiological way that insulin works in a traditional patient. But sometimes those little boluses are on a sliding scale, and that can be very complicated and confusing as well. And we can sometimes get into that vicious circle of chasing the numbers when those little bolus doses are sliding scale as well. So what I'm proposing and what I've seen coming from the American Diabetes Association is a more rational approach, especially in older individuals, of basal bolus dosing. So what we see there is starting with a basal or long-acting insulin, and then for the largest meal of the day, doing a bolus only for that particular meal and see how the patient does. And if the patient's doing pretty good with that, that may be where you stay. If their glucose control continues to go out of whack in the morning and the evening or overnight, then you can start adding in an additional bolus perhaps in the morning or in the evening. But for anybody that's worked the floor, some of these patients are getting stuck and getting injections four or five times a day, and on top of that, finger sticks, and it's kind of madness. You know, you talk about quality of life and think, is there a more rational approach? So that did come from the ADA, the long-acting once a day, and then starting with one bolus with the largest meal, and some patients are able to survive on that. And if you're sending patients home, if they're just with you for a short time, that may be actually easier for them to manage at home. So I am just promoting, you know, stop the madness with some of these really crazy insulin regimens unless it's really necessary. Something else that is adding to the confusion of insulin is the fact that we now have an exploding market in diabetes care. We have a bunch of new insulin products and several different ways that they can be administered. I just did a count yesterday, and right now there are almost 20 different types of insulin out on the market. This is a vastly different change from 5 or 10 years ago when there were only a handful. On top of that, you have different size insulin vials. There is an inhaled insulin out there, and there are the insulin pens, all of which work a little bit differently. So something that in the past had been very easy, you just take a vial and you draw up the insulin, even that was prone to problems. Now we're layering on top of it all these different products and different ways the different products work. So some of the common errors that we continue to see around insulin from the pharmacy perspective, we still do see people using units quite a lot, the abbreviation U instead of units, and that is a problem. In electronic health records, the way some of these insulins have been labeled is confusing, and we've had some errors because the insulin concentration is being confused for the insulin dose. We have some new drugs on the market that sound similar or look similar, for instance, Toujeo, which is insulin glargine, and Traceba, which is insulin Gludec. We continue to still have issues with not dating insulins when they're open and not throwing them away after their expiration dating. And actually, the expiration dating is also all over the map. Some are good for 14, some 28, and some 42 days. With the insulin pens in particular, many of them have to be primed, so your nursing staff really need to know how to use those devices to ensure the correct dosing is getting to the patient. You have to make sure you have needle tips for the pens. I've seen nurses try and take a traditional insulin syringe and pull insulin out of a pen because they don't have the right needle tips. And also make sure that the label is not on the cap of the insulin pen because that can be taken off and put on the wrong pen. Make sure your label is on the body of the insulin pen. And I've seen problems with facility staff opening multiple pens at once because they can't find the one pen that was open. They go to the fridge and pick out another one and have another one open. And just to end, some of the other high-risk areas we still continue to see, and if you're looking at particular patients that might be at especially high risk, look at those who have multiple insulin orders. And we've seen a lot of duplication of orders because of all these new types of insulins. Folks are not aware that they may have two long-acting insulins ordered, and it can be very confusing. And, of course, a longstanding issue is eating and insulin timing administration. That always continues to be a problem because, of course, if you give an injection and the patient doesn't eat, then you're setting yourself up for hypoglycemia, and that does continue to be a problem. So I think we've hit our 15-minute mark. I will turn it back over to you.
All yours, Ann, and I think I'll put a plug in for our next two-week call. So 2 weeks from now, Jen and I will be talking about the focus survey on high-risk meds and that litany of, that Jen just went through to talk about the problems we see with insulin. It was a great springboard to talk about what kind of systems you should have in place, what kind of documentation you should have available for surveyors when they look at medication management. So, we'll be following up on many of these themes in 2 weeks. Andy, you there? You may still be on mute. And?
I am here. I'm sorry. You're right. At the conference board, I mute everybody. So just wanted to let everybody know that the call that Bill is referencing is March 8th. And if you do want to listen to the recording again, you're welcome to go to the Leading Age Maryland website. And if you go within the Education tab, within 10 minutes of each call, we go ahead and post the recording, and then any handouts that Jen or Bill have referenced throughout the call will be posted as well. So if you like the call and you want to share it, please encourage your teammates to go ahead there and listen. We'll see you and hear you again on March 8th for our next Tuesday stand-up, which is Focus Surveys, Adverse Drug Events. Thanks, everyone, for joining, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.